Thinking Aloud from the University of Warwick.
Hello and welcome to another instalment of Thinking Aloud, where we discuss scholars' favourite historical sources. I'm Matthew Jackson, a first year PhD student working on drink and identity in early modern England and France. And joining me today to talk about his favourites is Professor Mark Greengrass, who has written extensively on the history of 16th and 17th century Europe. Professor Greengrass is renowned for his intensive study and application of printed and manuscript primary sources, and a brief selection of his work includes a study of the years of political crisis and remarkable recovery during the reign of Henry IV, the context and impacts of the European Reformation, the political pragmatism of religious pluralism in early modern France, and the performative rhetoric of Henry III and his advisers. Professor Greengrass's expertise in source material has also led to his most recent co-edited publication entitled The Virtual Representation of the Past, where he asks important questions about the advantages and challenges presented by the new age of digital research and online sources. I'm therefore delighted to welcome Professor Greengrass. Thanks for joining us today. And I'd like to begin by asking you, what is your favourite primary source, and what is it about this source that makes it stand out from the crowd?
Thanks, Matt. Inevitably, the favourite source is the stuff that you're working on at the moment. The stuff that I'm doing at present is a project called Communication and Power in Renaissance France. And it's looking at the kinds of networks, informal more than formal, that enabled power to be expressed at a distance. And immediately you say power expressed at a distance, it's the latter that is the epistolary framework that we can use to study, because letters both are frameworks of archiving reference, but also ways into cultures of communication, ways of addressing, but ways of communicating. And I think letters are absolutely fascinating sources. There's an absolute explosion of them, of course, in early modern Europe, and there are still pretty substantial amounts of material that have simply never been looked at in the French context, of a kind that this side of the Channel would have already received pretty extensive treatment. So one of these collections, which I'm working on with a group of colleagues at Paris, University of Paris 13, is a series of 30,000 or so letters which are in the archives of Chantilly, which are the correspondence of the lieutenant in that province, a man called Simeon de Gordes. What you've got in this, I mean, we've only worked through 1 year's worth of this. We've taken the year of the massacre of St. Bartholomew. And already, it's some absolutely fascinating stuff's tipping out of it. Have the, first of all, the silence about the massacre, and then the ways in which the massacre of St. Bartholomew becomes referred to from different parts of the province. There's also a very interesting traffic with Italy, because Dauphiné is the kind of route way for letter correspondences. Year before Lepanto, it's very interesting how the news about Lepanto comes through Simeon de Gordes to the French court, with initially the news being that the battle's been lost. 24 hours later, no, it's not been lost at all, it's been won, and then a third letter saying we're absolutely not sure what's happened at all, which is of course the reality of how things work. So in terms of information traffic, a letter is an interesting thing, but then of course you've got all the other components of letter letters as evidence, as material for how you address one another, the sort of things that you don't include in a letter, which are almost as important as the things that you do. When a letter is simply a way of saying, I think you're a great person and I'm sending this letter to tell you so, letters which are of clientage and requests, petitions, the letter has been so much more worked on in English sources, and it's just one of the areas where it's catch-up time for
Brilliant. Thanks for that, Mark. Very thought-provoking answer there on the rich potential of letters. So, moving on to secondary sources, what is your favourite, and what do you think it is about that secondary source that challenges the way historians do their trade?
When you mean secondary source, you mean published sources,
yes.
or published
modern secondary
modernary commentaries, modern
yes.
history, as it were,
yes.
modern history. That's an interesting question. Well, inevitably, I'm immediately reflecting on the things that I've read recently, which have impacted upon me, and. There, it's a much wider basket of things. I'm very impressed by the work that French historians have done on the literary culture of early modern France. Their work is really not well known in this country, and it should be better known. The work of Alain Viala and Christian Jouhaud. Christian Jouhaud wrote a lovely book called The Hand of the Cardinal, La Main du Cardinal, which is really about how, in Richelieu's letters, it's an effacing power. And it's a very interesting cultural reading of letters. But their work on the paratexts of pamphlets is very, I think, powerful. The basic proposition is that what happens, which is strange and needs explanation in 17th century France, is that its literary culture becomes depoliticized, that there is a mutual agreement that there are certain subjects that you don't publish about. And it's not just that Richelieu or the absolute monarchy somehow, by censorship or other forms of drowning out perhaps cacophony of self-projection of the monarchy. It's an agreement from the base as much as from on high that there are certain subjects, particularly religious division and politics, that you don't talk about in print. You might talk about them in a salon, the growth of salon culture is important as providing avenues of discussion. But really, there are more interesting things that you should be talking about, including science and literary culture, of purely literary. And the argument is, it's an argument which was already foreshadowed in Jürgen Habermas's famous work on the public sphere, that if you want to see the beginnings of an autonomous public sphere, it's actually in Paris in the middle of the 17th century that it happens. And in which case, that the story about the development of something that's autonomous, but which doesn't talk about power and these other things, the growth of a kind of autonomous literary culture with figures that see themselves as part of that, this is actually rather important. So, I'm interested in that. I've been reading their works a lot and impressed by them, and really wanted to see how the story goes backwards from there. What happens in the 16th century is part of power and communication. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. As a final question, I can't really help but ask this one. Given your kind of expertise and interest in the flourishing development of digital history, is there a particular favourite online source or digital archive that interests you most? Mm.
Yes, well, there are so many, and one of the problems is keeping up to date with what has been published. And one of the things that we're not very good at doing yet, I think, is evaluating these sources in the kinds of journals of record where we evaluate everything else so scrupulously. The kinds of sources that we as historians are most interested in are those where we can interrogate them and get useful answers of the kind of questions that we wouldn't have been able to ask and answer beforehand. That's the theory behind producing them. They cost a lot of money, so there's no point in producing these materials online unless one can start to ask and answer questions, what I call third-order questions beyond those which are confirming what you already know, which is sort of first-order stuff. Second-order stuff is beginning to answer the things, but you can't get the beginning to ask the questions, but you can't get the answers. Third order is where you can actually ask and answer. Field Bailey stuff is my favourite, not because I'm an 18th century historian, I'm not, but just because I think it's an absolutely fabulous example of how you can ask and answer questions that you simply otherwise wouldn't have been able to. And I suppose it's also a favourite because I did some work with a colleague in computing science, which was really the provided some of the computing science substructure to how that works. And that was fairly crucial to that. Not because we discovered the answers, but because we made such a hash of it that the old Bailey could only do better, and it duly did. In other words, he'd learned from our mistakes.
Fascinating. Well, that concludes today's highly interesting discussion, which leaves me only to thank Professor Greengrass once again for joining us, and our listeners for tuning in.
Thanks, mate.